Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Today we are strapping in for a deep dive, and it looks, well, less like a standard research paper.
Definitely. More like architectural blueprints for existence itself, maybe.
Exactly. It's very conceptual. We're talking metaphysics, complexity theory.
And this proposal for a whole new philosophy, this inevolutionary confluentism.
Yeah, the source material we have is, well, unique. Diagrams, deep definitions, big questions.
Huge questions, like, what is perfection? How does change really work?
And the big one for today, maybe.
Yeah.
What's the link between simple and complex?
Uh-huh.
So our mission, really, is to synthesize all this high-level stuff, try and translate it.
Make it useful for you, the listener.
What does it tell you about, say, managing information overload?
Yeah.
Or finding some stability when everything feels chaotic?
And it all kind of kicks off with this core question the source just throws out there.
Which is?
Is more complex, more perfect.
Which, you know, instinctively you kind of nod along. More features, more detail.
Yeah.
Feels more developed, more perfect, right?
You think so? Like a complex machine seems better than a simple tool.
Or a complex ecosystem versus, I don't know, a single-celled organism.
But the source, boom, throws a curveball right away. The answer isn't just yes.
No.
It says yes and but not only.
Ah, okay. That not only is doing a lot of work there.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying, hang on, just chasing complexity, that might be missing the point. It's a flawed goal on its own.
And they bring in Kierkegaard to back this up with that quote.
Yeah, it's a great little note, very human. He says something like, I don't like to say anything is perfect because I will worry too much about caring for it afterwards.
In case it is not being perfect anymore after. I love that. It's so relatable.
Totally. It grounds this whole lofty philosophical thing. Perfection sounds great, but then you have to maintain it.
And that maintenance, that's its own kind of complexity, isn't it?
A massive complexity problem.
Mm.
The effort to keep something perfect might just, you know, make it unsustainable. It collapses under its own weight.
Okay, so let's dig into that paradox of perfection the source lays out. It says the whole we live in has to be the more complex perfect.
Which on one level makes sense. The universe, everything. It's got the most variety, the most detail. It has to be the most complex thing there is.
Seems logical.
But then here's the pivot. The twist for anyone trying to manage information or build something stable.
What's the twist?
The source says this whole well, it could just be the more perfect if it's also the more simplifiable, too.
Whoa, okay. So perfection isn't just about how complex something is.
No, it's also about how easily you can sort of boil it down, how efficiently you can grasp it, manage it, understand its essence.
So the ability to simplify is actually part of its perfection.
Precisely. Think about really elegant code. It might do incredibly complex things.
Right.
But the beauty is often in the simple core structure it relies on. It's maintainable because it's fundamentally simple underneath.
So maximum complexity is only really valuable if you can radically simplify it when needed.
Exactly. If you can't distill it, it's not perfect. It's just complicated.
Yeah.
Maybe even Baroque, like the source implies.
Okay, so the goal isn't just complexity for complexity's sake. It's manageable complexity.
You got it. Which leads straight into the next question the source tackles.
Which is?
What could be the more simple and more complex thing?
Mm-hmm.
How can one thing be both?
That sounds like a contradiction.
Relation is what matters most anyway.
So it's not just the quadrants. It's the connections between them. The
yeah.
tension. The flow.
Exactly. The power is in that relationship. How does stability relate to dynamism? How does simplicity relate to complexity?
And the source uses that columns versus rows example to show this, right?
Yeah, it's a neat little illustration. Take a simple repeating pattern, like 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Okay.
If you write it down in vertical columns, one into the other, the source says it looks more stable, simple.
Right. You see the pattern immediately. It feels organized, predictable,
yeah.
stable.
But then take that exact same sequence, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, and write it out horizontally in Rosas.
What happens then?
The source suggests it suddenly looks more dynamic, complex.
Even though it's the identical data.
Identical data. Just changing the structure, the relation between the elements changes how we perceive it. Is it simple? Is it complex? It depends on how it's arranged.
So simplicity and complexity aren't just inherent properties. They emerge from the relationships.
That's what the source seems to be arguing, yeah. It's about structure and observation.
Okay, so if simple and complex are always related, always in tension, you need a word for that combination.
Right, and the source tries one. Simple X, combining simple and complex.
Makes sense.
But, because this is philosophy.
Yeah, here we go.
They immediately criticize their own word. They say simplex, just like that, is too simple or maybe too complex. It doesn't quite capture it.
So what does capture it? How do they refine simplex?
This is maybe the most important definition for you, the listener, to grab onto. The true, more simple X, it's defined by concepts being equivalent while varied.
Equivalent while varied. Okay.
Yeah.
Unpack that a bit. What does that mean in practice? If I'm building something.
Think about modular design, like building blocks.
Okay.
The simplex part, the foundation, is the standardized connection point. The way the blocks snap together. That's the equivalent part. It's simple. It's always the same.
Got it. And the varied part.
That's all the different types of blocks you can attach. Different shapes, colors, functions, infinite variety, infinite complexity, potentially.
But it all builds on that simple, stable, equivalent connection.
Exactly. That simple foundation. That's the simplex ground.
Yeah.
Stay stable, letting all that variety, all that complexity kind of fractal out from it reliably.
Without making the whole thing fall apart.
Right. The simple core enables stable complexity.
So simplicity isn't the opposite of complexity here. It's more like the necessary bedrock for it.
That's a great way to put it. It's like Occam's razor applied to everything. Find the simplest, most stable foundation.
The source calls it a simple ground for more stably fractaling the more complex varieties from it.
Yes. Simplex is that grounding mechanism. It makes stable complexity possible.
Which leads to some pretty clear advice, doesn't it? Whether you're doing science or just managing a project.
Absolutely. The source says, always try falsifying simpler options first.
Meaning?
Look for that core simple thing, that equivalent but varied structure before you start adding all the complex bells and whistles. Nail the foundation first.
But we often don't do that, do we?
No. And the source calls us out on it. It says, basically, we, very complex beings, tend to overlook fundamentals to be more simple. And so we mess.
Guilty as charged, I think. We jump to the exciting, dynamic, complex stuff.
Without establishing that stable, simple foundation, we skip the simplex step. We want the variety without the equivalence.
And that's why things break down. Systems become unstable.
That seems to be the implication. Now, this idea, this equivalent while varied bipole, it doesn't just describe structure. It drives change, too.
How so?
The source links it to two kinds of movement. Moving towards more simple, that's called involutionary.
Involutionary, okay.
And moving towards more complex, that's evolutionary.
But evolution is expanding, growing, adding complexity, variety.
Right, moving outward. And involution is kind of collapsing back, streamlining, returning to that simple, stable core, finding the equivalence again.
Okay, so systems are always sort of cycling between these, evolving complexity, then involuting back to simplicity.
That's the picture it paints. A constant cycle, expansion, and retraction. And the source labels this whole process as fundamentally adaptive.
It's how the system learns and adjusts, by exploring complexity and then simplifying what works.
Exactly.
So if we zoom out now, take this bipolar adaptive engine and apply it to the biggest scale possible, the universe as a whole.
Yeah, the source tries to connect the more simple micro, the tiny fundamental bits, with the more complex macro, the biggest possible picture.
Complex is described as holistic fractal and more stable.
Yes, it's the totality. And the source actually ties the highest level of perfection back to this continuum. It says the system is the more simple X and more varied perfect if it embodies this stable holistic range.
But wait, if the continuum is perfect and stable, how does imperfection fit in? Where does the messy, unstable stuff live? You said the complex macro might be unstable?
Good question. And the source addresses it directly. It needs that imperfection, paradoxically.
Why would a perfect system need imperfection?
Because that's the engine of change, of adaptation.
Yeah.
The source states that the more complex macro happenings can be seen the most imperfect, too.
Imperfect how?
It labels them experimental, random, and even fatal.
Fatal. Wow. That's intense for just being complex.
It is a strong word.
Yeah.
But think of it as the frontier. Maximum complexity, maximum variety. That's where the risks are highest.
So if a system gets super complex but hasn't figured out how to simplify itself yet, how to find that simplex core?
It's out on a limb. It's experimental. It might not last. It's potentially fatal to itself because it's strayed too far from the stable, simple ground. High complexity, high entropy, high risk.
Okay, so the complex macro has to be potentially imperfect, random, fatal.
So the whole system, the continuum, can explore possibilities, test boundaries, learn what works.
And then involute, simplify, and integrate the successful experiments back into the stable simplex core.
That's the dynamic. The instability at the edge is necessary for the stability and adaptation of the whole. It's a constant feedback loop.
Right, which brings us, I think, to the final synthesis.
How correct.
The source kind of looks at its own explanation.
And realizes it's got a bit complicated.
Yeah, it describes this whole system with a mouthful of a phrase, yeah. Deterministic, varied, fractal, bipolar, wholeism.
And then immediately says, yeah, that's too wordy complex, which is pretty funny, actually.
It is, practicing what it preaches. So how does it simplify that label?
It coins a new term. One word to capture the whole dynamic.
Which is?
In evolutionary confluentism.
Confluentism. Like a confluence. A flowing together.
Exactly. The flowing together of these opposites. Mm-hmm. Simple and complex. Involution, evolution. Stability and dynamism. Micro and macro.
It's the simplex name for the complex reality it's describing.
You nailed it. Hashtag tag tag outro.
Mm-hmm.
So when we boil this whole deep dive down, what we're seeing is that real health in a system, real stability, perfection even. It's not just about piling on more complexity.
No, it seems to be about finding and maintaining that simplex core, that equivalent but varied foundation.
Right. The simple ground that allows complexity to emerge reliably, stably, to fractal out without causing collapse.
And confluentism is the name the source gives this whole picture, this holistic, deterministic dance between simplicity and complexity.
That's the takeaway.
So if the universe, the whole allegory, finds its perfection partly in its ability to be simplified, that's a pretty clear message for us, right? As people trying to learn, trying to manage complex lives or systems.
Definitely. We are, as the source puts it, those imperfect, random, and experimental complex macro happenings.
Sounds about right. And it reminds us we tend to mess things up.
By overlooking fundamentals to be more simple. By skipping that vital simplex step.
So if this confluentist system is ultimately stable and deterministic because of this balance, maybe the responsibility falls on us. On the experimental complex parts.
Responsibility for what?
To consciously seek simplification. To actively engage in that involutionary process, streamlining things, finding the stable core.
That seems to be the implication. We, as the complex agents, need to provide the drive back towards simplicity to maintain the overall balance.
Which leaves you, the listener, with a final thought to chew on, I suppose.
Okay.
If every complex system needs to return to that simple ground to stay stable,
right.
Where are you maybe operating out there in the fatal zone, the complex macro?
In your work, your learning, your life.
Yeah. Where have you maybe built up too much complexity without checking the foundation?
Right.
And what essential simple ground, what equivalent core do you need to find? And as the source says, falsify first before you add any more variety.
A highly specialized philosophical system called confluentism.
Yeah, and it's important to say right off the bat, this is very much a self-defined philosophy. You're not going to easily find it indexed in, you know, the usual academic places.
Okay.
The source material presents it as an ideal metaphor. The goal seems to be creating this foundational unifying mechanism that works across every field, physics, sociology, you name it.
Right. So our mission today is really to cut through some of that terminology, understand what this unifying mechanism actually is, and maybe dig into why its proponents think it integrates or even improves on related theories we already know.
Exactly. And that initial definition they give is dynamic bipolarity that fractalizes everywhere.
Dynamic bipolarity fractalizes. Okay, let's unpack that. What does that mechanism actually look like?
So to really get it, you have to start with their first principle. Simple jited. It's a bit of a mouthful. Translates roughly to simple complexity.
Simple complexity. Okay.
The basic idea is that for any system to be fundamentally stable, it has to start with the absolute simplest possible expression. And metaphysically, they argue that simplest expression is a dynamic bipolarity.
A duality.
A duality, yeah. Which the source often calls bitheism.
Okay, wait. Let's nail down bitheism. Are we talking literally two gods here, or is this just a fancy way of saying fundamental duality?
No, it's definitely the latter, but with a sense of foundational urgency, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Bitheism here means that necessary duality, the two primal, equal, interacting forces you need for anything to be created or keep flowing.
It's the simplest engine.
It's the simplest engine that can run a complex universe, exactly. If you had just one pole, nothing happens, right? Inert. If you had three or more right at the start, chaos, instant instability. Two poles give you the tension, the dynamic that allows for, well, everything.
And historically, where do they see this idea rooted? They point east, don't they?
They do, very clearly. They argue the deepest and most ancient expression of this whole confluentism idea is actually Taoism. Think Laozi, Zhuangzi.
Right. Yi-yang-yang.
Specifically yin-yang, which they define here as reciprocal codetermination, that constant interplay, light and dark, being, non-being.
I saw they use some interesting Taoist synonyms, too. Things like dynamic confluence of processes,
yeah.
emerge in harmony from interaction,
mm-hmm.
linking it to Tao, the way, and Wu Wei.
That's it. It captures that sense of ongoing process, nonlinear flow. It's not static.
And you can definitely see echoes of that in more modern thought, right?
Oh, absolutely. They draw lines to process philosophy, you know, Whitehead.
Yeah.
The principle of polarity or complementarity from Bohr in quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely contemporary systems theory. People like Fritjof Capra talking about dynamic homeostasis. It all comes back to this idea that stable things rely on balancing two necessary competing forces.
Okay, but here's where I start to wonder. If the core idea is ancient, like Taoism, and it's been formalized by people like Whitehead,
right.
Why create a new term, confluentism? Doesn't that risk being just rebranding? They talk about avoiding a vanguardization trap, but isn't this potentially doing the same thing?
That's a really fair challenge, and honestly, the authors seem ready for it. They argue the need for confluentism comes down to semantic rigor, precision in language.
How so?
Well, they actually spend quite a bit of time critiquing related terms, especially process, as used by Whitehead. They call it a conceptual redundancy.
Wow, okay. That's pretty strong language in philosophy. What's redundant about process?
Their argument is basically that process just bloats the observational uncertainty that philosophy already assumes. It's too vague, essentially.
Right.
Meaning when you just say process, you immediately have to ask, well, what kind of process? Linear, holistic, fractal, cyclic. It needs adjectives to give it real meaning.
Ah, I see. So confluence is meant to be the more precise, all in one term.
That's the claim. They argue confluence is inherently more prepositional. Its etymology, they say, already implies three key things all at once. That fractal bipolarity we mentioned, holism, and flow.
So it directs your attention differently.
Right. It points to the whole system and the interaction of forces, whereas process might just imply movement without specifying the nature of that movement. That's key to their claim of having better analytical precision.
Okay. That makes sense as an argument. Building on that precision, let's talk about the structure they propose.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just two poles, is it? There's a twist.
Exactly. This is maybe the most unique bit. While the foundation is that bipolarity, two poles, confluentism puts a huge emphasis on a third element, or rather a structure of three parts.
Which case?
It's the idea that the really critical thing for understanding how systems work isn't just the two poles, but the one X in the middle of those two poles.
There's a space between them.
A space between, yes, but not just empty space. It's an active zone.
Okay, that sounds like it's trying to model the real world better, which is rarely just clean either.
That's precisely the point. They formalize this with what they call the fuzzy logic prism. Think of it as two discrete poles, like yin and yang.
Right.
And one fuzzy centroid. That's the term they use. This middle X, it's unstable, sure, but it's also the essential space where integration happens, where the dynamic action really occurs.
So unlike maybe some dialectics focusing on thesis, antithesis, synthesis, they're saying focus on the messy moment of interaction, the fuzzy bit.
Yeah, or at least give it equal, if not more, weight. If you think about really polarized situations today, maybe in politics or society, most analysis just jumps between the two extremes, right? Pole A versus pole B.
Absolutely.
And confluentism would argue that's why those analyses often feel static or incomplete. By focusing intensely on that middle only, the fuzzy centroid, you're acknowledging that pure opposition is kind of an abstraction. The messy, unstable, confluent middle is where change, adaptation, and actual dynamic stability get negotiated.
It's the buffer zone that allows opposites to coexist.
Exactly, without annihilating each other. It's essential.
Okay, let's broaden the view again. A huge part of this philosophy is this call for integration across fields, driven by wanting to avoid that vanguardization trap you mentioned earlier.
Right. The vanguardization trap. It's basically the tendency for new theories or movements to define themselves by rejecting or just ignoring what came before, believing they've totally surpassed it.
And they give examples.
Yeah, pretty powerful ones, like Nietzsche confronting Protestantism, or how Marx's anthropology largely ignored Darwinism, which was emerging at the same time. The idea was we've moved beyond that.
But the cost is losing connection to the foundations, losing potentially valuable insights or constraints.
Exactly. You end up weakening your own system. They point to early sociology, like Comte, who linked psychology and religion, the psychosocial, they'd call it. Later, sociologists tried to specialize by dropping the religious or deep psychological bits.
And arguably lost some explanatory power.
That's the argument. To be truly robust, you need to integrate your intellectual ancestors, not just dismiss them.
So, to avoid that trap themselves, confluentism tries to build this unified taxonomy, this concept the source is called bipolar varied fractal holism.
That's a mouthful.
It is. So we'll mostly use the shorthand, confluentism. It's fundamentally a new lens, a way of seeing the universe where influence doesn't just flow, you know, linearly.
Like A causes B causes C.
Right. Instead, it converges. It comes together from different directions. And the key challenge it tackles is understanding how we, as, you know, thinking, acting beings, process these simultaneous, often opposite influences. From the tiniest scale, the micro world.
Like particles or genes.
Yeah, exactly. And from the largest scale, the macro world. Society, the cosmos, the big picture stuff.
Okay, so why should you, listening right now, care about this?
Well, because confluentism really challenges how we think about, well, everything. Causality, how complexity arises, and that classic philosophical fight, free will versus determinism.
Uh-huh.
If we're actually being shaped by everything all at once from opposite directions, mm-hmm. well, our current models might need a serious upgrade.
Okay, let's start digging into that, this bipolar dynamic you mentioned. The sources talk about micro, macro, and we, the observer, the participant in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And the standard view, the one we usually default to, is pretty linear, right? Micro stuff like our biology or physics that creates us.
Right. Bottom-up creation.
And then the macro world, like society or the universe, that influences us, kind of top-down influence.
And in that neat linear model, our actions seem clear-cut too. We create complexity when we sort of move outwards towards the macro, building things, forming societies.
Expanding our world.
Exactly. And we simplify or maybe preserve memory when we look inwards towards the micro, focusing, remembering, reducing information. It's a tidy story.
It is tidy, maybe too tidy. The sources argue it's fundamentally incomplete. So where does confluentism shake things up?
Okay, this is where it gets really mind-bending. Confluentism introduces what the sources call the be-fluent perspective. Forget simple back and forth. The claim, and it's a bold one, is we consonantly, be-fluently create, complexify, and simplify in two opposite directions at the same time.
Whoa, okay, say that again. Be-fluent, by confluence. Let's translate that. Does it mean we're getting hit by two opposing streams of influence simultaneously?
That's a good way to put it.
Like maybe a river pulling us downstream towards simplicity, the micro level stuff, but also pushing us upstream towards complexity, the macro stuff, all at once.
That river analogy works quite well, actually. Think of yourself right now. You are, in this view, a confluence, a meeting point.
Okay.
Of micro R influences your genetics, your biology are constantly working, simplifying incoming data into, you know, manageable functions, keeping you structured, preserving you.
Right, maintaining the status quo.
But at the exact same moment, micro R influences societal norms, environmental cues, everything out there are pushing you to adapt, to make complex choices, to change your behavior, complexifying you.
So we're being determined and we're determining, simplifying and complexifying all the time.
All at the same time. That's the core idea of bifluent by confluence.
That actually feels quite intuitive when you stop and think about it. But you're right. We really resist that idea, don't we? The sources mention this big psychological barrier. Why is it so hard for us to accept this duality?
Yeah, it seems to boil down to what the sources call egolatry willing.
Egolatry, like self-worship.
Sort of, yeah. It's our deep-seated need to believe we're the ultimate authors of our own story, masters of our fate.
Okay.
So we find it easy to accept the micro-influence. We know we have biological limits. Physics applies to us. That makes sense within a materialist view.
Right. That fits. We're made of stuff. Stuff has rules.
But accepting the macro-influence as a source, not just an influence, but something that actively creates and, crucially, simplifies us.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
That implies more determinism from the outside.
Exactly. If we admit the macro pole isn't just a backdrop, but is actively shaping us, structuring us, even simplifying us, that suggests a level of determinism that, frankly, scares us.
Uh-huh.
It clashes hard with our anti-deterministic bias, our desire for total freedom, the egolatry willing. We want to be the special ones, moving out from the micro, creating everything ourselves. Not also being, well, simplified or shaped by something bigger, something cosmic.
It's an ego thing. We worry that accepting that macro pull means giving up our agency completely.
Yeah, so we tend to dismiss it. Call it fatalism, which is a much simpler, easier target to knock down than grappling with complex, confluent determination.
That resistance, that fear of determinism, it leads us right into the next part, doesn't it? The philosophical landscape confluentism is trying to navigate.
It does.
The sources lay out this kind of conceptual evolution, an in-evolution of thought, starting from one core problem.
And that core problem, the absolute bedrock challenge, is compatibilism.
Compatibilism, trying to make free will and determinism play nicely together.
Exactly. How do you square that circle? The sources argue that any system of rules or ethics, any deontology, ultimately has to wrestle with compatibilism at its root. And what's really neat is how they trace the development of human thought from that challenge. It's like watching ideas evolve to tackle this fundamental tension.
Walk us through that chain, because it seems to link things we normally keep separate, like religion and science.
Okay, so it starts with compatibilism, the basic need to reconcile freedom and fate. According to the sources, this naturally evolves into teleology.
Teleology, the study of purpose, final causes.
Precisely. Once you start thinking maybe determination and free will can coexist, the immediate next question is why? What's the point of it all? What's the purpose of this setup?
So teleology is chasing the why.
Exactly. And from chasing the why, you get theology. When people look for a really comprehensive why, and also what's the nature of this determined system, they developed divine frameworks. Theology defines that structure, often personified as God or creators.
Okay, makes sense. What's next?
Next up is philosophy. It sort of evolves from theology by shifting the focus more towards how things work and what they are, often trying to rationalize those divine structures or replace them with abstract principles, less dogma, more logic.
Right.
And finally, science continues that trajectory, zeroing in on the empirical how does stuff actually work and the observable, testable why of specific phenomena.
Wow. So it's one continuous thread of inquiry all bubbling up from that original knot.
Mm-hmm.
How do determinism and free will fit together?
That's the argument. And if you accept that chain.
Then the philosophical realist who talks about an objective reality out there.
And the theologian talking about an all-powerful deity.
They're essentially just using different kinds of teleology, different answers to why, that grew out of the same basic struggle with compatibilism.
That's the unifying insight confluentism offers here. It sees popular philosophy, like realism, often leaning on anti-deterministic teleologies, think reality, as this independent force we interact with.
We have freedom within reality.
Right. Whereas popular theologies tend to use deterministic teleologies, often centered on GA, as the ultimate determining cause.
God has a plan.
Exactly. Confluentism doesn't pick a side. It asks, how do these apparently opposing views conflue? How do they meet back at that shared root of compatibilism?
It suggests they're just two different partial takes on the same deep human need to find purpose in a world that feels both determined and free. Yeah, that's a potentially powerful way to reframe some long-standing debates.
It could be.
But okay, if that's the potential, why aren't we doing it? Our current ways of thinking, especially in academia, often seem to reinforce the divisions. Which brings us to segment three, the critique. The sources give this pretty blunt list a resume of popular flaws within the academia.
Yes, and most of these flaws, when you look closely, seem to circle back to that difficulty, that systemic inability in academic circles to handle determination without feeling like freedom is under attack.
Okay, let's look at flaw one. It says freedom is used to bully destiny as fatalism. What does that mean?
It means setting up a false fight. Instead of engaging with the sophisticated idea of complex determination, how micro and macro influences might shape possibilities, academics often attack the easiest, weakest version. Fatalism, the idea that everything is rigidly preordained and you can't do anything about it.
Like a straw man argument.
Exactly. Yeah. You knock down the straw man of fatalism and declare victory for absolute freedom without ever grappling with the real, trickier concept of determination.
It's intellectually easier, I suppose. What about flaw two? Using determinism for reductionism. Finiting within an infinite entropy. That sounds complicated.
It sounds dense, but the idea is quite direct. It critiques the tendency to take deterministic laws, like in physics, and use them to chop reality up into neat, finite, predictable boxes. We try to reduce everything to simple cause and effect chains.
Trying to make everything measurable and contained.
Right. Even though concepts like entropy, and especially the measurement problem in quantum physics, strongly suggest that reality, at its edges, is infinite, chaotic, and resists being perfectly boxed up. Our measurements themselves affect the outcome.
So we're imposing finite limits on something fundamentally infinite or unpredictable.
That's the critique. We want the universe to be reducible. But the deeper we look, both micro and macro, the fuzzier those neat boundaries become.
Okay. And these flaws creep into how we use core physics concepts, too. Flaw four is about misapplying the uncertainty principle.
Yes. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is fundamentally about the limits of observation. Right. You can't perfectly know a particle's position and momentum at the same time. It's a limit on measurement.
Got it.
But the sources argue it often gets misapplied way beyond that, specifically to teleology, to the very idea purpose or why.
How does that happen? How do you apply measurement limits to purpose?
Well, if you take the principle to mean that fundamental reality is inherently uncertain or fuzzy, and then you extend that fuzziness to the concept of purpose itself, you end up implying that any ultimate why must also be inherently uncertain or unknowable.
Ah, so it sidelines the search for purpose.
It effectively dismisses it, yeah. It turns purpose into a kind of statistical artifact of our limited view, rather than potentially a real foundational aspect of reality we should be investigating. It conveniently ignores that deep need for teleology we talked about earlier.
That's a subtle but really important distinction. Okay, what about flaw 3? It mentions the anthropic principle. The idea the universe seems fine-tuned for life. It says strong versions are ignored, but also buzzed at the same time.
Right. This means we often rely on the implications of fine-tuning when it suits an argument maybe in cosmology or biology discussions. We kind of hint at purpose.
Like, isn't it amazing how perfect things are for us?
Exactly. But we shy away from rigorously defining or defending that purpose because doing so feels too... well, too teleological, too deterministic. It's like wanting the benefits of the argument without committing to its uncomfortable philosophical baggage.
An intellectual fudge, as you put it earlier.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And the final one, flaw 5, takes aim at how we define ourselves. Freedom and will are called rupturist speciesists.
Rupturist speciesists. Meaning?
It means we tend to define uniquely human things, like cognition and consciousness, using, frankly, vague buzzwords. And we position ourselves, humans, as the exceptions of the species that ruptures the normal, deterministic, confluent rules that seem to apply to everything else in the universe.
We're special. We break the mold.
That's the implicit claim. We define ourselves as uniquely undetermined, often without really solid, rigorous evidence, beyond just asserting it.
Which loops right back to that egalitary willing. The whole academic setup sometimes seems geared towards protecting human exceptionalism and this idea of radical freedom, even if it means twisting principles or dodging hard questions.
And that systemic resistance, that insistence on keeping things in rival camps, is precisely why confluentism issues its core instruction. The more rivalized dichotomy, the better to confluent it.
Use the conflict itself as the raw material.
Exactly. Confluentism sees that tension, that rivalry, not as a problem, but as evidence. Evidence that there's a deeper unified reality that both sides are only partially grasping.
You see these rivalries everywhere, right? The sources mention idealism versus cognitivism versus panpsychism in psychology.
Three different ways of looking at the mind, all potentially partial.
Or Darwinism versus pleomorphism in biology, different takes on how evolution works.
Again, maybe just describing different aspects, different scales of the same complex micro-wee macro process.
And this connects to the idea of centroidal philosophers.
Yes, those thinkers, particularly in philosophy of science, who naturally find themselves in the middle ground between pure realism, reality is entirely independent, and anti-realism, reality is mostly subjective or constructed.
They're instinctively more confluentist.
You can say that. They recognize that the truth likely lies in how those two poles, independent reality and subjective perception, interact and meet. They embrace the confluence.
So confluentism isn't about picking winner and loser between rival ideas. It's about mapping how they both emerge from and point towards a single, more complex, underlying reality. It turns the rivalry into a tool.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
So to kind of wrap this up for you, the listener, the core takeaway here is that confluentism proposes this really fundamental shift in perspective. We're not just actors on a stage. We are constantly, simultaneously simplifying inputs from the micro world and complexifying our interactions with the macro world.
While also being shaped, influenced, even simplified by both of those poles all at once.
It's a dynamic, two-way, simultaneous flow.
So what does this mean practically? Maybe the next time you run into one of those big debates like, say, nature versus nurture or individual freedom versus social structures.
Classic dichotomies.
Yeah. Instead of picking a side, maybe pause and ask, could these two apparently opposing views actually be describing different points on that same continuous micro-e-macro line? Are they partial truths that need to be brought together?
Are they both reflecting aspects of a larger confluent reality that includes both determination and anti-determination?
A way to find the bigger picture.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And maybe one final thought to leave you with, something provocative from the sources. It touches on that idea of simplification.
Okay.
The source notes that our own mental processes, how we filter information, create memories, simplify the buzzing confusion of the world to make sense of it. That this actually mimics how the complexest macro source simplify us.
Wait, our simplifying mimics the universe simplifying us?
That's the suggestion. So if we, as conscious beings, find it absolutely necessary to simplify reality just to be able to function and perceive, what does that imply about the nature of the ultimate macro source, the universe itself, that presumably must be simplified for creatures like us to even exist within it? What kind of complexity are we simplifying? Concepts like self-reference, temporal strategy, biological bipolarity. Pretty heady stuff. Okay, let's unpack this.
Right. The mission really is to distill the core blueprint from these sources. Excellent. You know, get that essential why behind things. It's dense, absolutely.
But the insights are pretty profound, wouldn't you say, about how consciousness maybe operates?
I think so. And that's why we need to, you know, take our time a bit. We're basically looking at an ontological framework, a theory of being. It argues that individual uniqueness, yourself, is always trying to maximize its footprint, its space within the whole system.
Through those three things you mentioned,
yeah.
How we see ourselves, how we deal with time, and how biology forces this kind of duality.
Exactly. And the absolute core, the engine driving it all, is something the sources call autoreferentia egoletra.
Which we're translating as egolatry or self-reference.
Yeah, that seems the best fit.
So let's start right there. Egolatry. Huh? Most people hear that and think, well, narcissism, selfishness.
Right, the common understanding. But the source uses it much, much more broadly.
Absolutely.
It's like the essential link you have just with yourself. Your self-esteem, sure, but also just your presence.
Yeah.
The energy needed to be a unique thing.
The engine of uniqueness itself.
Precisely.
And then, this is where it gets interesting, this egolatry gets amplified. Through interaction with other unique entities doing the same thing.
Yes, exactly. It creates this kind of collective amplification loop. Everyone's driven by the same need for self-reference.
And the ultimate goal is expansion.
Always expansion. Every unique thing tries to grab the most possible space using the least amount of, well, physical stuff. Minimum body, maximum presence.
Across space and time.
Across maximum space and time, yeah. Replicate itself as much as possible. It's described as a universal mandate, almost.
Okay, if everyone's trying to maximize expansion, shouldn't that just lead to constant, immediate conflict? How do we manage that?
Well, the sources say we manage it through comparison. Quite sophisticated comparison, actually.
How does that work?
Two main strategies happening at once. First, we look for similitude. We find others we can relate to, you know, our tribe, our group.
Finding common ground to magnify the egolatry safely together.
Right. But second, and this is the really counterintuitive part, we also seek difference. We do this by, well, sort of tricking ourselves.
Tricking ourselves how?
By intentionally seeing ourselves as smaller compared to some new group or context.
Wait, hang on. We deliberately make ourselves feel smaller? Isn't that the opposite of expanding egolatry? Why would we do that?
The argument is that this temporary self-minimization, this little act of self-deception, it's like training.
Training for what?
It prepares us for future interactions. How to negotiate, maybe even deceive other entities later on. It's practice for complex social stuff.
Ah, okay. So it's a tool. And if that tool breaks or gets misused?
Then you get the extremes. The source points to narcissism and sociopathy as basically abuses of this comparison mechanism.
They're disorders of spatial negotiation, in a way. Refusing to ever minimize.
That's a good way to put it. They refuse that minimization step, even the temporary strategic kind.
Which brings us neatly to the aha moment, I think. If we're all driven by this expansion, how do we ever form lasting connections?
Yeah.
What is a bond, a vinculo, in this view?
The definition is really elegant, I think. A vinculo, a bond, is basically a tacit agreement.
An agreement.
Yeah, between unique entities to actively hide or minimize their own egolatries. Just enough so the other person's egolatry has room to exist.
It's not about merging or selflessness. It's resource allocation.
Pretty much. An efficient agreement about space. It's a constant negotiation.
Yeah.
So every relationship, friendship, family, it's an ongoing negotiation of self-space. Like, I'll shrink a bit here if you don't expand so much there.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. We're constantly making offers, setting boundaries within that bond. And the quality of the bond is how well that negotiation works over time.
Okay, so moving from the space we take up now, let's talk about time. Projecting that egolatry forward, starting with originality or originalidad.
Right. The source defines this as the key measure of quality and novelty, but maybe not in the way we usually think.
Meaning?
Originality isn't preferred because it's super complex or took immense skill. It's preferred because it allows lots of interpretation without being totally vague. And crucially, the truly original, it reflects or gets close to the origin, the simpler, more fundamental source of things.
So the best new ideas aren't the most complicated, but the simplest ones that connect us back to something primal.
That seems to be the idea. And related to that, there's a slightly cynical note in the sources about how much effort we put into appearing original. A lot of it is just tinkering. Trestio is the word used, often just done for applause.
For social validation, egolatry showing off again.
Exactly. Investing in visible complexity to prove our uniqueness is being noticed, amplified. It's like replication insurance through validation.
And that desire for validation, for long-term recognition, that ties directly into temporal strategy.
Absolutely. If egolatry wants maximum benefit, the temporal strategy is how it plans to get it over time.
The core principle is kind of brutal.
It is stark, yeah. No egolatry gives up maximum possible self-benefit. It just calculates that it might gain more in the long run by getting a bit less right now.
Temporal polar mechanics.
Yeah.
Trading short-term for long-term.
That's the concept. And it gets applied to some really complex things, like altruism, even suicide.
Okay, let's unpack that.
Yeah.
Altruism or suicide
yeah.
as short-term minimization of egolatry, sacrificing immediate presence.
For a calculated investment in a greater, longer-lasting presence or memory in other people.
That feels incredibly cold. How does that math work? Giving up your life for remembered presence.
The source presents it as, well, almost a logical outcome of self-reference seeking maximum duration. If an act creates a huge ripple effect martyrdom, a widely discussed death that sustained memory in the collective consciousness is seen as a larger, longer-term egolatry footprint than a quiet life might have offered.
A strategic trade-off. Wow.
Okay, challenging perspective. Let's focus on the human strategy then. Medioplicismo, medium-termism.
Right. This is apparently where we differ from a lot of the universe.
How so?
If you look at really basic matter like atoms or simple life like bacteria, they tend towards extremes. Either immediate combination, very short-term, or incredible long-term stasis, surviving unchanged for ages.
Not much middle ground.
Not much. But humans, we operate smack in the middle, medium-term.
And why is that? What centers us there?
Our biology forces it. Specifically, how slowly our offspring mature.
Our babies are helpless for so long. Exactly. That demands a much longer, sustained, medium-term bonmaire vinculation between the new generation and the mapadres, the parenting unit.
Mm-hmm.
Our biology dictates our time frame.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Shifting from time strategy to the biological architecture behind it. Dimorphism. Male and female systems.
Yeah, it's fascinating how, despite all the complexity of life, sexual reproduction fundamentally resolves into just two distinct anatomies, male, female.
The macro scaling of a fundamental bipolarity, femininity and masculinity.
The essential dual framework needed for this kind of reproduction, yes.
And the sources map specific compensatory time strategies onto these biological forms.
They do, directly linked to that medium-term human strategy we just discussed.
So, the female strategy, gynocentrism.
That's described as having a shorter time focus and a subject space focus, concentrated on the direct, concrete, felt experience, bonding in the here and now of her own life, immediate reality.
Okay. And conversely, the male strategy, patrilineality.
That's framed with a long time focus and an object space focus, geared towards more abstract, dispersed reproduction. Competing for future memory, sociological legacy.
You can see this super clearly at the micro level, right? The gametes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The reproductive system is called the most dimorphic system we have. Look at the ovum.
The egg cell. Huge, scarce, maximum concentration of energy. It's like conserving the past, holding on to memory, the origin.
That's the interpretation. And the sperm, the micro equivalent, tiny, super abundant, designed for dissipation.
Its goal is the opposite, abducting the future, connecting outward.
Described as an abductor of the distant future, yeah. Connected to the environment, the agent of change, projection.
And this intense duality, this push-pull, it creates what the source calls reciprocal engineering.
It does, and uses that really striking phrase. The other gender is our architect jailer.
Whoa, what does that mean?
It's a dramatic way to describe coevolution. The idea that the way one gender develops its structure, its behavior has been massively shaped by the sexual preferences and needs of the other gender.
We design each other, in a way.
Deeper.
To compensate and also limit.
Exactly. We supposedly know our own limits by seeing the obvious gifts of the other gender.
And the examples given are pretty pointed. men limit women's psychological gifts with their clumsier psychology.
And women limit men's sociological gifts with their clumsier sociology. That's the framing. The system ensures neither side completely dominates the egalitarian game.
It forces negotiation, keeps the complexity going.
The tension is the generator. It ensures both strategies have enough tools for self-reference and expansion, ultimately serving the egalitarian of the species as a whole.
So, okay, we've covered a lot of abstract ground. What does this structural view of motivation and biology actually mean for us listening to this? Is there a takeaway?
There is. The source proposes a path, maybe for self-improvement. It suggests that if we recognize the specific gifts of the other gender, their time strategy, their spatial focus, and consciously try to emulate those gifts in our own way,
we improve ourselves.
We improve our own microscopic sources, that deep primal engine of self-reference. It's about building the compensating skills that your architect jailer, so to speak, naturally provides.
Okay. So we've gone from that core drive, egalitarian, through negotiated bonds, the human medium-term focus, and landed on this necessary compensatory biological design.
A big journey. And maybe we should end near the beginning, intensity-wise. The zygoto-utopia.
A fertilized egg.
Yeah. The source makes this incredible claim. The 100 most intense seconds you'll ever live were compressed into less than 1 second when you were a zygote.
Maximum egalitarian, minimum space. Pristine genesis.
The ultimate point of origin that our complex lives are always in some way trying to remember or recapture.
Which leads us to that final provocative thought from the source material about the pineal gland.
Ah, yes, the premortem pee.
That's noted the pineal gland activity peaks right before death, much like it does shortly after birth. Why have that farewell peak?
It's speculative, of course, but one justification offered is interesting, that this final surge is the egalitarian desperately trying to connect.
Connect to what?
To the best channels available, maybe? To send and receive the most vital information about its existence, its journey, perhaps trying one last time to reach back towards that original pristine zygote state.
The zygoto utopia, before it all dissipates.
Exactly. Something for you, the listener, to maybe ponder and explore on your own. The organism is a varied equivalent confluence of the micros and macros seen.
A confluence, meaning a meeting point.
Exactly. Where all the tiny forces below atomic, molecular meet the huge forces above cosmic, societal. It's the balance point, the literal center of this conceptual universe.
And it's not just about physical size, right? There's a behavioral link, too.
Yes, absolutely. The source draws a direct parallel. The microscale links to personal values and local habits.
Okay, inner world stuff.
While the macro scale, atmosphere, cosmos, all that links directly to social worldview, your bigger picture, right? So if you're building this absolute continuum, you can't just leave academic disciplines scattered around. This source had to align them, rank them according to this physical hierarchy. The section is literally called Sciences Ranked and Aligned with Matters.
Turning disciplines into stepping stones, basically.
Pretty much. Seamless transitions.
So let's look at how it stacks up. At the very, very bottom, highest micro, unit, particle, atom. What fields do we find? Metaphysics, physics, chemistry. And this term, mathologic, what's that?
Yeah, mathologic. It's not standard, obviously. It seems to represent the structural rules, the computational logic underpinning matter itself, like the idea that physics isn't arbitrary. It follows a kind of mathematical necessity. It connects the abstract metaphysics to the measurable.
Yeah, it's the universe's operating system, almost.
Kind of, yeah. It's a bold link.
Okay. Then you move up into what feels like biology's ground floor, macromolecule to cell. And here we see biophysics, biochemistry, molecular biology, genetics. That seems more intuitive.
It does. But even here, the source pushes for deeper connections than usual. It specifically says biochemistry is tied to the periodic table, obviously. But then it insists geology needs to be integrated right here.
Geology with molecular biology.
Yeah. It references Linneo's original classifications and apparently work by someone called Strunz, suggesting they tried to classify minerals and life together. It wants the Earth's chemistry integrated before complex biology.
Wow. Okay. A comprehensive physical chemistry of life foundation.
Something like that. And then bridging that organism level up to the universe, the fields trying to grasp the whole confluence.
Psychology and sociology, which seems like a massive leap, right? Atoms to societies.
It is a massive leap. And that's why this core rule the source lays down is so critical. It says matter and macros only evolve, quote, when all its inner ancestor layers in-evolve along.
In-evolve, not evolve.
In-evolve. with an IN. It seems to mean this necessary simultaneous internal evolution across all lower levels. So you can't have a big societal shift, a macro evolution, unless the underlying biology, chemistry, physics, the micro layers also shift internally to support it.
Everything has to move together. The foundation dictates the penthouse.
That's the idea. All scales progress in lockstep.
Okay, this is where, for me, it starts getting really wild. Moving from physical systems inside the body to abstract things like culture and language. It starts with the organization of biological systems, right?
Yeah, the bisystems.
The source lists the standard 11. Integumentary skin, digestive, circulatory, skeletal, endocrine, nervous, muscular, respiratory, excretory, reproductive, immune. The usual suspects.
Components of the organism.
Right. The building blocks of the organism.
Right.
But then the source zooms in on one specific pair within that system level. The endocrine and nervous systems, mm-hmm. hormones and nerves, the body's internal regulation and communication network.
Okay. And what does it do with that pair?
It maps them outward,
yeah.
conceptually.
Maps them to what? Language? Directly to linguistics, which the source actually calls a more macro pair of ordered systems.
Oh, okay. Slow down.
Hmm.
The argument is that our internal body communication hormones, nerve signals, is structurally the same as our external system for ordering society. Which is language.
Structurally equivalent, yeah. That seems to be the claim. The internal mechanism for command and control inside the body mirrors the external mechanism for command and control via speech.
So brain-to-gland communication is like the micro version of leader-to-group communication.
That's the analogy it seems to be drawing. And it doesn't stop there. This ordering principle extends even further.
Outward again.
Linguistics, this macro-ordered system, then extends to what it calls the most macro pair of ordered senses. Touch and view.
How do they fit?
The idea seems to be a direct lineage. Internal biological control, nerves, endocrine, enables abstract societal control, linguistics, which in turn shapes how we primarily interact with and order the external world through our dominant senses, touch view.
That's a heck of a conceptual chain reaction. Internal regulation, language, sensory interface.
It is a very specific, very structured argument about how complexity builds outward.
And from that highly structured organism, we finally step out into society proper through something called primer externality.
Exactly. To get from the individual organism to the group level community population, you need this primer externality applied to oneself first.
What does that mean? Testing yourself against the world.
Kind of. It sounds like the basic act of external interaction, the organism reaching out, interacting, testing its boundaries against the outside. But doing it to itself first, maybe internally modeling.
Okay. And that initial interaction, that self-applied test against the external.
That leads directly, according to the source, to the formation of culture and society, which then contain those macro factors we mentioned earlier, values, habits, and worldview.
Okay. Now we land on what might be the most ambitious and potentially sensitive part of this whole structure, linking the internal state of the organism psychology directly to the functioning of society via sociology. The source calls them two and four popular fields, psychosocial culture and society, better linked.
Into a single diagram, and our job is just to describe that diagram as impartially as possible.
Got it. So what does this ordered psychopathologies chart look like?
Okay, it's basically a two-axis model. Imagine a cross. One axis runs from inner, which it associates with the past and self-focus, out to outer, associated with the future and external focus.
Inner past versus outer future.
Okay.
And the other axis.
The other axis separates behaviors it labels as bipolar or neurosis from those it labels as psychosis or delirium.
Okay, two dimensions, inner-outer focus and neurosis-psychosis type.
Right, and then it uses some very specific and frankly extreme examples to kind of anchor the four corners of this map.
Such as?
Okay, so in the inner past culture corner, it places something called mitomania, which, you know, we might understand as pathological lying or fabrication.
Okay, inward-looking, past-focused, lying.
Yep.
And the opposite corner, outer future.
That corner is labeled pedophilia delirium, linked to outer future sociability.
Right, and the other two extremes, personal versus social.
The extreme focused inward on the self, the personal pole, is labeled masochism suicide. While the extreme focus outward, the social pole, is sadism psychopathy.
Wow. Those are loaded examples to anchor a chart. What's in the middle?
Along the axes connecting these extreme poles, you find the conditions maybe more commonly discussed. Trauma, depression, anxiety, addictions, stress, schizo, and so on. The fundamental claim here is that all these psychological states exist on a continuum, defined by their orientation on these two axes, self versus other, past versus future.
A physical scaled continuum for psychopathology. That's the idea.
That's the idea presented. And it doesn't stop there. This psychological structure is then immediately mapped onto the social world.
Through the ordered sociologies, connecting the economics, politics.
Exactly. It takes these psychological patterns, these extremes, and applies them directly to the functions of the state and the economy. How society manages resources and ensures survival.
How does it do that?
It uses two big categories for state function. Provision linked to capitalism and resource management, and protection linked to the estate, meaning defense, justice, that sort of thing.
Okay, providing and protecting, and it maps the psychopathologies onto these.
Directly. And again, these are highly specific and controversial pairings presented by the source.
Let's hear them. Under provision capitalism.
It places political mitomania, remember, the lying fabrication, economical pedophilia, and media narcissism.
Okay. And under protectionist state.
There, it maps judiciary masochism, the self-sacrificing pole, and military sadism, the outward aggression pole.
So the source is explicitly claiming that, for example, the judicial system's function structurally aligns with masochism and the military's with sadism.
That appears to be the direct claim, that these societal roles are functionally defined by, or at least structurally predisposed to, these psychological extremes from the other chart.
That's quite a leap. Arguing that state functions are essentially predetermined by these foundational psychological biases, which themselves derive from the same scale that started with subatomic particles.
It's a jaw-dropping conceptual chain, yes. Unifying everything with a vengeance. Hashtag tag outro. So when you boil it all down, the core concept this taxonomy is trying to get across is that all matters as an equivalent varied biconfluences.
That term biconfluences seems really key. It means it's constant dual pole. The micro forces, personal, internal, particle level stuff.
And the macro forces, social, cosmic, external pressures, both converging on the organism, influencing it constantly and simultaneously. It's always being shaped by both ends of the spectrum.
So what's a big takeaway here for you listening to this? I think it's the sheer audacity of trying to create this single framework. It suggests everything you see, whether it's a chemical bond or a political strategy or an economic trend, can potentially be mapped onto one structure, where complexity isn't random, but emerges from these scaled, interconnected pairs, starting from the simplest level, like an intellectual skeleton key for, well, everything.
Yeah. Which leaves us with a pretty provocative question to chew on, doesn't it? If you take this taxonomy seriously, even just as a thought experiment, if the universe really is, as the source suggests, the society of particles, and if our human society is built upon, or at least reflects, these foundational psychological and sociological biases laid out in that chart, then how much does that innermost ancestor layer, basic physics, chemistry, how much does it truly dictate our individual choices and our collective behavior?
Does the fate of the atom really echo in the rise and fall of empires? Something to think about.
Structure isn't just a list.
No, no. It's an argument in itself. It's saying the logic flows constantly from the most abstract philosophy right down to, like, really practical social applications.
Okay. Let's try to unpack that structure then, starting with the fields. The range is huge.
It really is. You start with the big ones, metaphysics, teleology, theology, deontology.
Yeah, then it moves quickly through mathologic, physics, chemistry, biology.
And then crosses over into the human side, linguistics.
Yeah.
Then the psychosocial field, which bundles psychology and ethics together.
And finishes in the really applied stuff. Economy, industry, marketing, it covers so much ground.
But what really gives it its conceptual backbone, I think, are the add-ons. They aren't just labels. They seem to be the system's core hypothesis about what defines each field.
Okay, like what?
Well, for metaphysics, the add-on is confluentism, which sort of suggests the system sees metaphysics as being fundamentally about things flowing together. You know, convergence.
Confluentism and chemistry. What's the add-on there?
That one's really specific. Carbosilicon.
Carbosilicon. So based on carbon and silica.
Exactly. It's like the framework is saying chemical reality at its core is built around the bonding mechanisms of those two elements. It defines the field by its preferred way of building structure.
Okay, I see. But you said things get really critical when we hit linguistics.
Yeah, this is where it gets, well, really interesting, like you said. The add-on for linguistics is symbionimity.
Symbionimity, like symbiosis, mutual benefit.
Seems like it, yeah. Like interaction through language or symbols. But then right after that, in the psychosocial field, psychology and ethics, the add-ons are love, joy, and wise.
So the linguistic structure comes right before the emotional and ethical stuff.
Exactly. And that connection is just crucial. Symbionimity implies this beneficial exchange, probably through language. Putting that right before love, joy, and wise, it's proposing something pretty radical.
What? That our deepest feelings, love, joy, wisdom, are somehow structured by language rule.
That seems to be the implication. That these psychological states are maybe processed, maybe even defined, by the rules of symbiotic linguistic interaction. It's like it's trying to quantify human emotion using the rules of grammar and relationship.
Hang on, that's a massive leap, isn't it? If love is defined by linguistic structure, does that mean it's not really internal, but more a function of shared communication?
Precisely. It's a challenging idea. And that leads us straight into the apps column. This is where these concepts get operationalized, turned into applications.
And this column is a real mix, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a conceptual blender. Like you said, you've got technical tools, Simplex, Cyclone, fuzzy logic.
Alongside those very human concepts. Souls, trustful, free, reward.
Right. The apps are like the output layer. They take these abstract rules and turn them into, well, usable metrics or functions.
Okay, before we dig into how those apps actually work, we need to quickly look at the key system. You mentioned that earlier. It sounds like the grammar underneath it all.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The key organizes everything using numerical ranks and labels, things like OXY2 and FOXY2. But the really important part is how it divides reality into two basic types.
Which are?
Concretions and abstractions. Concretions are things like ancestoring, relations, standards, basically. Fixed, definable structures.
Okay. Solid things. And abstractions.
Those are the more fluid concepts. Pure, art, smart, liberty, community, improvement. They represent potential, ideals, things that aren't necessarily fixed.
So every field, add-on, and app gets tagged by this key system, telling us if it's fundamentally rigid or flexible.
That's the idea. The system uses these tags to maintain its own internal logic. So if an app deals with, say, economic standards, that's tagged as a concretion. If it deals with liberty, that's an abstraction. It sort of defines the rules of engagement for that element.
Right, we've got the abstract rules, the grammar. Now, where does the system connect back to, you know, actual physical reality? You mentioned substances and continuum tables.
Exactly. This is where it gets grounded. We start right at the bottom, the absolute basics. The vertical hierarchy begins with substances.
Like?
Unit, particle, atom, molecule, macromolecule, then protoplasm. That's your basic physics and chemistry layer.
Okay, the building blocks.
Then the structure flows up into biology, cell, tissue, organ, systems, and even systems pairs. And this progression isn't just random. It maps specific scientific fields onto these levels.
Ah, so you can see how complexity builds. Like, biophysics applies at the parka level.
All right. And cytology, the study of cells, is defined by the cell level. Neuroimmunology pops up when you get to systems pairs. It's like an evolutionary map showing how complexity emerges layer by layer.
And does it keep going beyond organ system?
Oh, yeah. That biological scale continues right out into the wider world using standard taxonomy.
Yeah.
You go from domain, like eukaryote, through kingdom plant, animal, fungi, then phylum, like vertebrate, class, order, family, genus.
All the way to sapiens.
Exactly. The system is basically saying, look, the rules that govern a tiny unit particle are fundamentally the same rules that ultimately define human beings, just scaled up and interacting differently.
Wow. Okay. So to understand those universal rules, we need to talk about this Taiyinian thing you mentioned. That's key to the whole system's dynamics.
It seems to be the absolute core engine, yes. It uses this ancient tripartite concept, T-A-O, Y-I-N, Yan-Yan, to understand interactions at every single scale, from atoms up to societies.
Right. So T-A-O is the center.
T-A-O is the central organizing principle. It's associated with things like confluence, intention, formation. The balancing point, maybe.
And Yin and Yan are the two opposing forces or complementary forces.
Complementary is probably better. Yin is the sort of discrete, grounded, structuring force. Think discrete, essence, mass.
Okay, structure, like what?
Well, in physics, maybe decay forces. In chemistry, that foundational carbosilicon bonding we talked about. Processes of creation. It's the fixed architecture, the blueprint.
Got it. Which means Yan must be the active moving force.
Exactly. Yan is linked to expand, continuous substance. This covers the dynamic elements, weak forces in physics, the movement of electrons, neutrinos, processes of transformation. It's the energy of the action.
Okay, I think I get the physics part. But how does this Taoyinian idea apply in, say, biology? You mentioned DNA and RNA. That seems less intuitive.
It actually makes a kind of sense if you frame it right. Think of YN as the stable blueprint and YAN as the active messenger or process. Uh-huh. So DNA is the stable essence, YIN, of the cell. It's the fixed structure, the core information. But RNA and processes like transcription and replication, those are about transformation and expansion, YN. They use the DNA blueprint to do things, to build, to change.
And TAO fits in how?
The central organizing processes, like cell division, mitosis, and meiosis, those get associated with TAO, the formation and intention principle. It's a very elegant way to try and fit literally every known physical and biological process into this single dynamic framework.
Right. We've gone from TAO all the way up the biological ladder to sapiens.
Yeah.
Now, let's shift to maybe the most unique part of this system, the personal soul app. This feels like a huge jump, trying to define individual people using these universal principles.
It is a big leap. The soul's profile is basically built by linking two core elements that a user chooses, an animal and a color.
An animal and a color.
Yeah. It seems to be the system's attempt to map what it sees as deep biological archetypes onto conscious preferences or self-perception.
Okay, how does that work? The animal choice. The system links that to cell speciation. What does that mean?
It seems to me that your choice of animal archetype reflects some underlying biological tendency or pattern. And this animal dictates three inherent qualities the system calls offers. Basically, what your profile suggests you naturally provide to the world.
Okay, so I pick an animal, and that defines my offers and the color.
The color, or VUW, as it's sometimes called, is tied to the organism level, the whole being. Choosing a color and its qualities dictates three things the system calls wants. What your profile suggests you seek from the world or from others.
Okay, I have to push back a bit here. We've been talking about this framework, striving for rigorous consistency, grounding itself in physics and biology, but choosing an animal and a color, doesn't that make this whole soul application feel really subjective? Arbitrary, almost.
That's the obvious criticism, yeah.
How does the framework justify this leap from, say, carbosilicon chemistry to me picking, I don't know, an eagle?
Well, the defense, as far as I can tell, is that the choice only looks arbitrary to us. The framework claims these animal archetypes aren't just random symbols. They represent definable biological outputs stemming from that cell speciation idea. These outputs manifest as predictable patterns of behavior and contribution the offers.
So the system takes my subjective choice, I feel like an eagle, and maps it back to what it considers an objective archetype score. The eagle's specific biological offers.
That seems to be the claim, yes. It's definitely a bold one.
Okay. Let's use the app mock-up example they provide to make this clearer. Step one. User thinks of an animal. Let's stick with eagle. That locks in their three inherent offers, whatever the system says eagle offers.
Right. Step two. The user thinks about a color, say yellow. Then they choose three qualities they associate with yellow. The example uses adjective B, adjective D, and brave. That selection defines their three wants.
And then the app gives you an analysis.
Exactly. The output says something like, you are eagle. That's your core offering. Then it looks at your color choice. You say you are brave. That's your self-perceived want or quality.
And crucially, it also seems to suggest what other people might want or expect from you based on the other qualities associated with yellow that you didn't pick.
Yeah, it seems to use the color association as a way to calibrate your self-perception against a kind of external expectation matrix, all supposedly rooted back in that biological animal identity.
Wow. Okay. And you mentioned there's an extended model, too.
Uh-huh. It pushes the quantification even further. It adds plant choice, linked to deeper offers, maybe subconscious contributions, and digestion, linked to something called weeper wants.
Weeper wants, linked to digestion. That's specific.
Highly specific. It seems like an attempt to quantify even deeper, maybe unconscious drives or needs through biological functions.
And it connects these archetypes right down to preferences. The example mentions three flavors eagle likes. So, based on my animal and color choice, the system could predict my personality and my taste in food.
Potentially, yes. If you chose, say, a sloth and the color gray, the system might generate a profile predicting not just your ideal job, but maybe even your preferred snacks. It's trying to be truly holistic.
Okay, so we have this quantified soul profile. Where does it go from there? How does it become practical?
This is the bridge, the KCAP, custom rewarded task. This takes that abstract, quantified soul profile and basically turns it into a practical metric for, well, for matching people for tasks in a sort of gig economy.
Right. The example shows matching two individuals, Bob and Alice, for jobs like labor help or homesitting.
Exactly. And the output is a MATSE score. But that score isn't just one number. It depends on three key metrics that are derived from the whole underlying system. Souls, trust, and deal.
Souls, trust, and deal. Okay.
And the example gives scores. Bob has a soul score of 42. Alice has 60.
Which straight away suggests Alice's profile, based on her animal color input, is maybe seen as having greater capacity or being more desirable in this context.
That seems to be the implication, yeah. More quantifiable soul, according to the system.
What's really important here, I think, is understanding how these metrics, soul, trust, deal, supposedly link back to those fundamental principles we discussed earlier, like Tai Yin Yang or the psychosocial add-ons. Is there a connection?
The system implies a clear lineage. The soul score itself, defining that core identity and capacity, the offers, that seems logically tied to the organizing principle, TAO. It reflects the individual's intention and formation, their core being.
Okay, soul links to Tao. What about trust?
Trust, which is about reliability, consistency, maybe following rules that seems to link pretty directly to YN, or maybe to the concretions in the key system, adherence to standards, fixed structures, dependability.
Right, the stable structuring force. That leaves deal. That just sounds like making a transaction.
And that fits perfectly with Yan. Deal represents the active, transactional, perhaps expansive energy needed for an exchange to happen successfully. It aligns with transformation, the need for improvement maybe, the dynamic part of the interaction.
So the whole matching process for a simple task is framed as an application of these universal Taoyinian forces playing out between two people.
That's exactly how it seems to be structured. It maintains that consistency right down to the application level.
Let's look at the scores for the labor help task again. The match scores are souls 60, trust 65, but deal only 25.
Right. So the high souls and trust scores suggest, according to the system, their core personalities and reliability are actually a pretty good match for this task. They get each other on some level.
But the deal score is low, only 25.
And that's the predicted sticking point. Despite aligning well on identity and trustworthiness, the system forecasts friction when it comes to the actual transaction. Maybe their negotiation styles, their expectations for reward, perhaps derived from those deep weeper wants, are just incompatible.